spoke without malice, but she knows there's an unpleasant kernel of truth in what he said. So, I'm a selfish, uncaring hack, blind to the needs of the true workers, and nasty to decent old men with a work ethic, she muses.
That's about the size of it.
Then he looks at her properly, and his expression changes.
What are you going to do to redeem yourself?
It's astonishingly hard to meet his eye. She's trying to work out how to answer when she hears her mobile phone. Sorry, she mutters, scrabbling in her bag. She clicks open the little envelope symbol.
Just wanted to say hi. Away Halls tomorrow. We'll be in touch when I get back. Take care. Jay. Kiss.
She's disappointed. Say hi after the whispered intimacies of the previous evening. The uninhibited coming together. He wants to say hi. She rereads the message. He never says much via the mobile phone, she knows that. He told her at the start it was too risky, in case his wife happened to pick it up before he could delete some incriminating message. And there's something sweet in take care, isn't there? He's telling her he wants her to be okay. She wonders, even as she calms herself, at how far she stretches these messages, finding a whole hinterland in the sparse words he sends to her. She believes they're so connected to each other that it's fine. She understands what he really wants to say. But occasionally, like today, she doubts that there really is anything beyond the shorthand. How to reply? She can hardly say, have a good holiday, when she wants him to have a terrible time, his wife to get food poisoning, his children to whine incessantly, and the weather to fail spectacularly, confining them all to a grumpy indoors. She wants him to sit there, missing her, missing her, missing her. Take care yourself. Kiss. When she looks up, Rory's eyes are fixed on the removals lorry outside, as if he's pretending not to be interested in what's going on beside him. Sorry, she says, tucking her phone back into her bag. Work thing. Aware, even as she says it, why she's not telling him the truth. He could be a friend, is already a friend. Why would she not tell him about John? Why do you think nobody writes love letters like these anymore? She says instead, pulling one from her bag. I mean, yes, there are texts and emails and things, but nobody sends them in language like this, do they? Nobody spells it out anymore, like our unknown lover did. The removal lorry is pulled away. The front of the newspaper building is blank and empty, its entrance a dark maw under the sodium lights, its remaining staff deep inside, making last-minute changes to the front page.
Perhaps they do, he says, and his face has lost that brief softness. Or perhaps, if you're a man, it's impossible to know what you're meant to say.
The gym at Swiss Cottage is no longer near either of their homes, has equipment that is regularly out of order, and a receptionist so bolshy that they wonder whether she's been planted there by some opposition. But neither she nor Nikki can be bothered to go through the interminable process of ending their membership and finding somewhere new. It has become their weekly meeting place. It's some years since they gasped alongside each other on the exercise bikes, or subjected themselves to the ministrations of pitying 20-year-old personal trainers. Now, after a few desultory laps up and down the small pool, they sit in the hot tub or the sauna for 40 minutes to talk, having convinced themselves that these things are good for the skin. Nikki arrives late. She's preparing for a conference in South Africa and has been held up. Neither friend will pass comment on the other's lateness. It's accepted that this happens, that any inconvenience caused by one's career is beyond reproach. Besides, Ellie has never quite understood what Nikki does. Will it be hot out there? She adjusts her towel on the hot bench of the sauna as Nikki wipes her eyes. I think so. Not sure how much time I'll get to enjoy it, though. New boss is a workaholic. I was hoping to take a week's holiday afterwards, but she says she can't spare me. What's she like? Oh, she's all right. Not knitting herself a pair of testicles or anything. But she really does put in the hours, and can't see why the rest of us shouldn't do the same. I wish we had old Richard back. I used to love our long lunch Fridays.
I don't know anyone who gets a proper lunch break now. Apart from you hacks. I thought it was all boozy lunches with contacts. Ha! Not with my boss on my tail. She tells the story of her morning meeting, and Nikki's eyes screw up in sympathy. You want to be careful, she says. She sounds like she's got you in her sights. Is this feature coming okay? Will that get her off your back? I don't know if it'll come to anything, and I feel weird about using some of this stuff. She rubs her foot. The letters are lovely, and really intense. If someone had written me a letter like that, I wouldn't want to put it in the public domain. She hears Rory's voice as she says this, and discovers she's no longer sure what she thinks. She'd been unprepared for how much he disliked the ideas of the letters being published. She's used to the idea that everyone on the nation shares a mindset. The paper first, old school. I'd want to blow it up and put it on a billboard. I don't know anyone who gets love letters anymore, Nikki says. My sister did, when her fiancé moved to Hong Kong back in the 90s. At least two a week. She showed me once. She snorts. Mind you, most of them were about how much he missed her bum. They break off from laughing as another woman enters the sauna. They exchange polite smiles, and the woman takes a place on the highest shelf, carefully spreading her towel beneath her. Oh, I saw Doug last weekend. How is he? Got Lena up the duff yet? He asked about you, actually. He's worried he upset you. Said you and he had words. Sweat has crept into Ellie's eyes, making the remnants of her mascara sting. Oh, it's fine. He just... She peers at the woman on the upper shelf. He lives in another world. One in which nobody ever has an affair. He came over a bit judgy. We had a disagreement about John's wife. What about her? Ellie shifts awkwardly on her towel. Don't worry about me, the woman's voice filters down. Everything overheard in this place is off limits. She laughs, and they smile obligingly back at her. Ellie lowers her voice. About how far I should be taking her feelings into account. I should think that's John's job. Yes, but you know Doug, the nicest man in the world. Ellie smooths her hair off her face. He's right, Nikki, but it's not like I know her. She's not like a real person. So why should I care what happens to her? She has the one thing I really, really want. The one thing that would make me happy. And she can't be that much in love with him, can she? And pay so little attention to what he needs and wants. I mean, if they were that happy, he wouldn't be with me, would he? Nikki shakes her head. Dunno. When my sister had her kid, she couldn't see straight for 6 months. His youngest is almost two. She feels, rather than hears, Nikki's shrug of derision. It was the perennial downside of good friends. They never let you get away with anything. You know, Ellie, Nikki says, lying back on the bench and putting her hands behind her head. Morally, I wouldn't care either way. But you don't seem happy. That defensive clench. I am happy. Nikki raises an eyebrow. Okay. I'm happier and unhappier than I've ever been with anyone else, if that makes sense. Unlike her two best friends, Ellie has never lived with a man. Until she was 30, she had assigned marriage and children, it was always one word, to the folder of things she would do later in life. Long after she had established her career, like drinking sensibly and taking out a pension. She didn't want to end up like some girls from her school, exhausted and pushing prams in their mid-20s, financially dependent on husbands they seemed to despise. Her last boyfriend had complained that he had spent most of their relationship following her while she ran from place to place, barking into a mobile phone. He had been even more pissed off that she'd found this funny. But since she'd turned 30, it had become a little less amusing. When she visited her parents in Derbyshire, they made conspicuous efforts not to mention boyfriends, so much so that it had become just another form of pressure. She's good at being on her own, she tells them, and other people, and at being the truth, until she met John. Is he married, love? The woman asks through the steam. Ellie and Nikki exchange a subtle glance. Yes, Ellie says. If it makes you feel any better, I fell in love with a married man. And we've been married 4 years next Tuesday. Congratulations, they say in tandem. Ellie, conscious that it seems an odd word to use in the circumstances. Happy as anything we are. Of course his daughter won't talk to him anymore, but it's fine. We're happy. How long did it take him to leave his wife? Ellie asks, sitting up. The woman is pushing her hair into a ponytail. She has no boobs, Ellie thinks, and he still left his wife for her. 12 years, she says. It meant we couldn't have children, but like I said, it was worth it. We're very happy. I'm glad for you, says Ellie, as the woman climbs down. The glass door opens, letting in a burp of cold air as she leaves. And then it's the two of them, sitting in the hot, darkened cabin. There's a short silence. 12 years, says Nikki, rubbing her face with her towel. 12 years, an alienated daughter, and no kids. Well, I bet that makes you feel loads better. 2 days later, the phone rings. It's 9:15, and she's at her desk, standing up to recognize it so that her boss can see she's there and working. What time does Melissa come to work? She seems to be first in and last out in features, yet her hair and makeup are always immaculate, her outfits carefully coordinated. Ellie suspects there's probably a personal trainer at 6 a.m, a blow-dry at some exclusive salon an hour afterwards. Does Melissa have a home life? Someone once mentioned a young daughter, but Ellie finds that hard to believe. Features, she says, staring absently into the glass office. Melissa is on the phone, walking up and down, one hand stroking her hair. Do I have the right number for Ellie Howarth? A cut glass voice, a relic from a previous age. Yep, this is she. Ah, I believe you sent me a letter. My name is Jennifer Sterling. What did I do? That Thursday you said you didn't want to let me go. Your words, not mine. And then nothing. I actually thought you had an accident. Someone said you did this before, and I didn't want to believe her. But now I just feel like an idiot. Female to male, by a letter. Chapter 19. She walks briskly, head down against the driving rain, cursing herself for not thinking far enough ahead to bring an umbrella. Taxis follow in the slipstream of steamy-windowed buses, sending sprays of water in graceful arcs over the curb. She is in St. John's Wood on a wet Saturday afternoon, trying not to think of white sands in Barbados, of a broad, freckled hand rubbing sun cream into a woman's back. It is an image that pops into her head with punishing frequency, and has done for the 6 days John has been gone. The foul weather feels like some cosmic joke at her expense. The mansion block rises in a grey slab from a wide tree-lined pavement. She trips up the stone steps, presses the buzzer for number 8, and waits, hopping impatiently from one soaked foot to the other. Hello? The voice is clear, less elderly than she had imagined. She thanks God that Jennifer Sterling suggested today. The thought of negotiating a whole Saturday without work, without her friends, who all seemed to be busy, was terrifying. That freckled hand again. It's Ellie Howarth. About your letters. Ah, come in. I'm on the 4th floor. You may have to wait a while for the lift. It's terribly slow. It's the kind of building she rarely goes into, in an area she hardly knows. Her friends live in new-built flats, with tiny rooms and underground parking, or maisonettes squashed like layer cakes into Victorian terraced houses. This block speaks of old money, imperviousness to fashion. It makes her think of the word dowager. John might use it, and smile. The hallway is lined with dark turquoise carpet, a colour from another age. The brass rail that leads up the 4 marble steps bears the deep patina of frequent polishing. She thinks, briefly, of the communal area in her own block, with its piles of neglected post and carelessly left bicycles. The lift makes its stately way up the four floors, creaking and trundling, and she steps out onto a tiled corridor. Hello? Ellie sees the open door. Afterwards, she's not sure what she had pictured. Some stooped old lady with twinkling eyes, and perhaps a nice shawl, amid a house full of small china animals. Jennifer Sterling is not that woman. In her 60s she might be, but her figure is lean and still upright. Only her silver hair, cut into a side-swept bob, hints at her true age. She's wearing a dark blue cashmere sweater and a belted wool jacket over a pair of well-cut trousers that are more Dries Van Noten than M&S. An emerald green scarf is tied round her neck. Miss Howarth? She senses that the woman has watched her, perhaps assessing her, before using her name. Yes. Ellie sticks out her hand. Ellie, please. The woman's face relaxes a little. Whatever test there was, she seems to have passed it. For now, at least. Do come in. Have you come far? Ellie follows her into the apartment. Again, she finds her expectations defied. No animal knick-knacks here. The room is huge, light and sparsely furnished. The pale wood floors sport a couple of large Persian rugs, and two damask-clad Chesterfields face each other across a glass coffee table. The only other pieces of furniture are eclectic and exquisite. A chair that she suspects is expensive, modern and Danish, and a small antique table inlaid with walnut. Photographs of family, small children. What a beautiful flat, says Ellie, who has never particularly cared about interior decorating, but suddenly knows how she wants to live. It is nice, isn't it? I moved here in 68, I think. It was rather a shabby old block then, but I thought it would be a nice place for my daughter to grow up, since she had to live in a city. You can see Regent's Park from that window. Can I take your coat? Would you like some coffee? You look terribly wet. Ellie sits, while Jennifer Sterling disappears into the kitchen. On the walls, which are the palest shade of cream, there are several large pieces of modern art. Ellie eyes Jennifer Sterling as she re-enters the room, and realizes that she's not surprised that she could have inspired such passion in the unknown letter writer. The photographs on the table include one of a ridiculously beautiful young woman posed as if for a Cecil Beaton portrait. Then, perhaps a few years later, she's peering down at a newborn child, her expression wearing the exhaustion, awe, and elation seemingly common to all new mothers. Her hair, even though she has just given birth, is perfectly set. It's very kind of you to go to all this trouble. I have to say, your letter was intriguing. A cup of coffee is placed in front of her, and Jennifer Sterling sits opposite, stirring hers with a tiny silver spoon, a red enamel coffee bean at the end. Jesus, thinks Ellie, her waist is smaller than mine. I'm curious to know what this correspondence is. I don't think I've thrown anything out accidentally for years. I tend to shred everything. My accountant bought me one of those infernal devices last Christmas. Well, it wasn't actually me who found it. A friend of mine has been sorting out the archive at the Nation newspaper and came across a file. Jennifer Sterling's demeanour changes. And in it were these. Ellie reaches into her bag and carefully pulls out the plastic wallet with the three love letters. She watches Mrs. Sterling's face as she takes them. I would have sent them to you, she continues, but... Jennifer Sterling is holding the letters reverently in both hands. I wasn't sure what, well, whether you would even want to see them. Jennifer says nothing. Suddenly ill at ease, Ellie takes a sip from her cup. She doesn't know how long she sits there, drinking her coffee, but she keeps her eyes averted. She isn't sure why. Oh, I do want them. When she looks up, something has happened to Jennifer's expression. She isn't tearful exactly, but her eyes have the pinched look of someone beset by intense emotion. You've read them, I take it. Ellie finds she's blushing. Sorry, they were in a file of something completely unrelated. I didn't know I'd end up finding their owner. I thought they were beautiful, she adds awkwardly. Yes, they are, aren't they? Well, Ellie Howarth, not many things surprise me at my age, but you have succeeded today.
Aren't you going to read them?
I don't have to. I know what they say. Ellie learned a long time ago that the most important skill in journalism is knowing when to say nothing. But now she's becoming increasingly uncomfortable as she watches an old woman who has in some way disappeared from the room. I'm sorry, she says carefully, when the silence becomes oppressive, if I've upset you. I wasn't sure what to do, given that I didn't know what your situation was, she says. She smiles, and Ellie thinks again what a lovely face she has. That was very diplomatic of you, but these can cause no embarrassment. My husband died many years ago. It's one of the things they never tell you about being old. She gives a wry smile. That the men die off so much sooner. For a while, they listen to the rain, the hissing brakes of the buses outside. Well, Mrs. Sterling says, tell me something, Ellie. What made you go to such efforts to return these letters to me? Ellie ponders whether or not to mention the feature. Her instincts tell her not to.
Because I've never read anything like them?
Jennifer Sterling is watching her closely.
And I also have a lover, she says, not sure why she says this.
A lover?
He's married.
Ah, so these letters spoke to you?
Yes, the whole story did. It's the thing about wanting something you can't have, and that thing of never being able to say what you really feel.
She's looking down now, speaking to her lap.
The man I'm involved with, John, I don't really know what he thinks. We don't talk about what's happening between us.
I don't suppose he's unusual in that, Mrs. Sterling remarks.
But your lover did. Boot did.
Yes. Again, she's lost in another time. He told me everything. It's an astonishing thing to receive a letter like that. To know you're loved so completely. He was always terribly good with words. The rain becomes briefly torrential and thunders against the windows. People are shouting below in the street. I've been mildly obsessed by your love affair, if that doesn't sound too strange. I desperately wanted the two of you to reunite. I have to ask, did you ever get back together? The modern parlance seems wrong, inappropriate, and Ellie feels suddenly self-conscious. There's something graceless in what she has asked, she thinks. She has pushed it too far. Just as Ellie is about to apologize and beg to leave, she speaks. Would you like another cup of coffee, Ellie? She says. I don't suppose there's much point in you leaving while the rain is like this. Jennifer Sterling sits on the silk-covered sofa, her coffee cooling on her lap, and tells the story of a young wife in the south of France, of a husband who, in her words, was probably no worse than any others of the age. A man very much of his time, in whom expression had been driven out, had become a sign of weakness, unbecoming. And she tells a story of his opposite, a crabby, opinionated, passionate, damaged man, who unsettled her from the first night she met him at a moonlit dinner party. Ellie sits, rapt, pictures building in her head, trying not to think about the tape recorder she has turned on in her handbag. But she no longer feels graceless. Mrs. Sterling talks animatedly, as if this is a story she has wanted to tell for decades. She says it's a story she has pieced together over the years. And Ellie, although she doesn't completely understand what is being said, doesn't want to interrupt and ask her to clarify. Jennifer Sterling tells of the sudden palling of her gilded life, the sleepless nights, her guilt, the terrifying, irrevocable pull of some unforbidden. The awful realization that the life you're leading might be the wrong one. As she speaks, Ellie bites her nails, wondering if this is what John is thinking right now on some distant, sun-drenched beach. How can he love his wife and do what he does with her? How can he not feel that pull? The story becomes darker, the voice quieter. She tells of a car crash on a wet road, a blameless man dead, and the 4 years she slept-walked through her marriage, held in place only by pills and the birth of her daughter. She breaks off, reaches behind her, and hands Ellie a photo frame. A tall, blonde woman stands in a pair of shorts, a man with his arm around her. Two children and a dog are at her bare feet. She looks like a Calvin Klein advertisement. Esme's probably not that much older than you, she says. She lives in San Francisco with her husband, a doctor. They're very happy, she adds with a wry smile, to my knowledge. Does she know about the letters? Ellie places the frame carefully on the coffee table, trying not to begrudge the unknown Esme her spectacular genetics, her apparently enviable life. This time, Mrs. Sterling hesitates before speaking. I've never told this story to a living soul. What daughter would want to hear that her mother was in love with somebody other than her father? And then she tells of a chance meeting years later, the glorious shock of discovering she was where she was meant to be. Can you understand that? I'd felt out of place for so long, and then Anthony was there. And I had this feeling, she taps her breastbone, that I was home, that it was him. Yes, says Ellie. She's perched on the edge of the sofa. Jennifer Sterling's face is illuminated. Suddenly Ellie can see the young girl she had been. I know that feeling. The awful thing was, of course, that having found him again, I wasn't free to go with him. Divorce was a very different matter in those days, Ellie. Awful. One's name was dragged through the mud. I knew my husband would destroy me if I tried to go, and I couldn't leave Esme. He, Anthony, had left his own child behind, and I don't think he ever really recovered from it. So you never actually left your husband? Ellie feels a sinking disappointment. I did, thanks to that file you found. He had this funny old secretary, Miss Thing. She grimaces. I never could remember her name. I suspect she was in love with him. And then, for some reason, she handed me the means to destroy him. He knew he couldn't touch me once I had those files. She describes the meeting with the unnamed secretary. Her husband's shock when she revealed what she knew at his office. The asbestos files. They had seemed so innocuous in Ellie's flat. Their power dimmed by age and hindsight. Of course, nobody knew about asbestos then. We thought it was wonderful stuff. It was a terrible shock to discover that Lawrence's company had destroyed so many lives. That was why I set up the foundation when he died, to help the victims. Here. She reaches into a bureau and pulls out a leaflet. It details a legal help scheme for those suffering work-related mesothelioma. There's not much money left in the fund now, but we do still offer legal help. I have friends in the profession who provide their services for free, here and abroad. You still got your husband's money? Yes, that was our arrangement. I kept his name, and became one of those rather reclusive wives who never accompanied their husbands to anything. Everyone assumed I'd dropped out of society to bring up Esme. It wasn't unusual in those days, you see. He simply took his mistress to all the social events. She laughs, shaking her head. It was the most astonishing double standard back then. Ellie pictures herself on John's arm at some book launch. He has always been careful not to touch her in public, not to give any indication of their relationship. She has secretly hoped that they will be caught kissing, or that their passion is so apparent they become the subject of damaging gossip. She looks up to find Jennifer Sterling's eyes on her. Would you like more coffee, Ellie? I'm assuming you're not in a hurry to be anywhere. No, that would be lovely, I want to know what happened. Her expression changes. The smile fades. There is a short silence. He returned to Congo, she says. He used to travel to the most awfully dangerous places. Bad things were happening to white people out there at the time, and he wasn't terribly well. She no longer seems to be directing her words at Ellie. Men are often a lot more fragile than they seem, aren't they? Ellie digests this, trying not to feel the bitter disappointment this information seems to induce. This is not your life, she tells herself firmly. This does not have to be your tragedy. What was his name? I'm guessing it wasn't Boot. No, that was our little joke. Have you read Evelyn Waugh? His real name was Anthony O'Hare. Actually, it's strange telling it all to you after all this time. He was the love of my life, yet I have no photographs of him, few memories. If it wasn't for my letters, I might have thought I'd imagined the whole thing. That's why you bringing them back to me is such a gift. A lump rises to Ellie's throat. The telephone rings, jolting them from their thoughts. Do excuse me, Jennifer says. She walks out into the hallway, picks up a telephone, and Ellie hears her answer, her voice immediately calm, imbued with professional distance. Yes, she's saying. Yes, we still do. When was he diagnosed? I'm so sorry. Ellie scribbles the name on her notepad and slips it back into her bag. She checks that her tape recorder has been running, that the microphone is still in position. Satisfied, she sits there for a few minutes longer, gazing at the family pictures, grasping that Jennifer will be a while. It doesn't seem fair to hurry someone who's evidently in the clutches of lung disease. She rips the page from her pad, scribbles a note, and picks up her coat. She goes over to the window. Outside, the weather has cleared, and the puddles on the pavement gleam bright blue. Then she moves to the door and stands there with the note. Do excuse me for one moment. Jennifer holds her hand over the receiver. I'm so sorry, she says. I'm likely to be some time. Her voice suggests that their conversation will not be continued today. Someone needs to apply for compensation. Can we talk again? Ellie holds out the piece of paper. My details are there. I really want to know. Jennifer nods, half her attention on her caller. Yes, of course. It's the least I can do. And thank you again, Ellie. Ellie turns to leave, her coat over her arm. Then as Jennifer is lifting the receiver to her ear, she turns back. Just tell me one thing, just quickly. When he left again, Boot, what did you do? Jennifer Sterling lowers the receiver, her eyes clear and calm. I followed him. There was no affair between us. If you try to suggest otherwise, I shall make it clear it was all in your imagination. Male to female, via letter, 1960. Chapter 20. Madam, would you like a drink? Jennifer opened her eyes. She had been holding the armrests of her seat for almost an hour as the BOAC aeroplane bucked its way towards Kenya. She had never been a very good flyer, but the relentless turbulence had ratcheted up the tension in the Comet, so that even the old Africa hands were clenching their jaws with every bump. She winced as her bottom lifted from the seat, and there was a wail of dismay from the rear of the plane. The smell of hastily lit cigarettes had created a fog of smoke in the cabin. Yes, she said, please. I'll give you a double, the air hostess said, winking. It's going to be a bumpy ride in. She drank half of it in one gulp. Her eyes were gritty after a journey that had now stretched to almost 48 hours. Before leaving, she had lain awake for several nights in London, chasing her thoughts, contradicting herself as to whether what she was attempting was madness, as everyone else seemed to think. Would you like one of these? The businessman beside her held out a tin, its lid cocked towards her. His hands were huge, the fingers like dry-cured sausages. Thank you. What are they, mints? She said. He smiled, beneath his thick white moustache.
Oh, no.
His accent was thick. Afrikaans.
They're to calm your nerves. You might be glad of them later.
She withdrew her hand. I went, thanks. Someone once told me that turbulence is nothing to be afraid of.
He's right. It's the turbulence on the ground you want to be careful of.
When she didn't laugh, he peered at her for a moment.
Where are you headed? Safari?
No. I need to catch a connecting flight to Stanleyville. I was told I couldn't get one direct from London.
Congo? What do you want to go there for, lady?
I'm trying to find a friend.
His voice was incredulous.
Congo?
Yes. He was looking at her as if she was mad. She straightened in her seat a little, temporarily loosening her grip on the armrests.
You don't read the newspapers?
A little, but not for a few days. I've been very busy.
Very busy, huh? Little lady, you might want to turn around and go straight back to England.
He gave a low chuckle.
I'm pretty sure you're not going to get to Congo.
She turned away from him to stare out of the aeroplane window at the clouds, the distant snow-capped mountains beneath her, and wondered briefly if there was the faintest chance that, right at this moment, he was there, 10,000 feet below her. You have no idea how far I've come already, she responded silently. 2 weeks previously, Jennifer Sterling had stumbled out of the offices of the Nation, stood on the steps with her daughter's small, chubby hand in her own, and realized she had no idea what to do next. A brisk wind had picked up, sending leaves scurrying after each other along the gutters, their aimless trajectory mirroring her own. How could Anthony have disappeared? Why had he left her no message? She recalled his anguish in the hotel lobby and feared she knew the answer. The fat newspaper man's words swam in her head. The world seemed to sway, and for a moment she thought she might faint. Then Esme had complained that she needed to spend a penny. The more immediate demand of a small child had hauled her out of her thoughts and into practicality. She had booked into the Regent, where he had stayed, as if some small part of her believed it might be easier for him to find her there if he chose to return. She had to believe he would want to find her, would want to know that she was free at last. The only available room was a suite on the fourth floor, and she had agreed to it easily. Lawrence wouldn't dare quibble about money. And as Esme sat happily in front of the large television, occasionally breaking off to bounce on the huge bed, she spent the rest of the evening pacing, thinking furiously, trying to work out how best to get a message to a man who was somewhere in the vast expanse of Central Africa. Finally, as Esme slept, curled under the hotel quilt beside her, her thumb in her mouth, Jennifer lay watching her in the hotel bed, listening to the sounds of the city, fighting tears of impotence, and wondering whether, if she thought hard enough, she might somehow send a message to him telepathically. Boot, please hear me. I need you to come back for me. I can't do this by myself. On the second and third days, she spent most of the daylight hours focused on Esme, taking her to the Natural History Museum, to tea at Fortnum & Mason. They shopped on Regent Street for clothes. She hadn't been organized enough to send what they had with them to the hotel laundry, and had roast chicken sandwiches from room service for supper, sent up on a silver salver. Occasionally, Esme would ask where Mrs. Cordoza or Daddy was, and Jennifer reassured her that they would see them very soon. She was grateful for her daughter's stream of small, mostly achievable requests, the routines imposed by tea, bath and bed. But once the little girl had fallen asleep, she would close the bedroom door and be filled with a kind of black fear. What had she done? With each hour that passed, the enormity and futility of her actions crept further in on her. She had thrown away her life, moved her daughter into a hotel room, and for what? She called the Nation twice more. She had spoken to the gruff man with the large stomach. Now she recognized his voice, his abrupt manner of speaking. He told her, yes, he would pass on the message as soon as O'Hare called in. The second time she had the distinct impression he wasn't telling the truth. But he must be there by now, surely. Aren't all the journalists in the same place? Can't someone get a message to him?
I'm not his social secretary. I told you I'll pass on your message, and I will. But it's a war zone out there. I'd imagine he's got other things to think about.
And she would be cut off. The suite became an insular bubble. Her only visitors the daily maid and the bellboy from room service. She dared not ring anybody, her parents, her friends, not yet knowing how to explain herself. She struggled to eat, could barely sleep, as her confidence dissipated, her anxiety grew. She became increasingly filled with the conviction that she could not remain alone. How would she survive? She had never done anything by herself. Lawrence would make sure she was isolated. Her parents would disown her. She fought the urge to order an alcoholic drink that might dull her growing sense of catastrophe. And with every day that passed, the little voice that echoed in her head grew more distinct. You could always return to Lawrence. For a woman like her, whose only skill was to be decorative, what other option was there? In such fits and starts, in a surreal facsimile of ordinary life, the days went by. On day 6, she telephoned her house, guessing that Lawrence would be at work. Mrs. Cordoza answered on the second ring, and she was humbled by the woman's obvious distress. "Where are you, Mrs. Sterling? Let me bring you your things. Let me see Esme. I've been so worried." Something in Jennifer sagged with relief. The housekeeper had come to the hotel with a suitcase of her belongings within the hour. Mr. Sterling, Mrs. Cordoza told her, had said nothing, except that she should not expect anyone in the house for a few days. "He asked me to clear up the study, and when I looked in there..." Her hand lifted briefly to her face. "I didn't know what to think." "It's all fine, really." Jennifer couldn't bring herself to explain what had happened. "I'd be happy to help you in any way I can," Mrs. Cordoza went on. "But I don't think he..." Jennifer placed a hand on her arm. "It's quite all right, Mrs. Cordoza. Believe me, we'd love to have you with us. But I think that may be difficult. And Esme will have to go home to visit her father quite soon, once everything has calmed down a little. So perhaps it'll be better for everyone if she has you there to look after her." Esme showed Mrs. Cordoza her new things and climbed onto her lap for a cuddle. Jennifer ordered tea, and the two women smiled awkwardly as she poured it for her housekeeper in a reversal of their former roles. "Thank you so much for coming," Jennifer said, when Mrs. Cordoza stood to leave. She felt a sense of loss at her imminent departure. "Just let me know what you decide to do," Mrs. Cordoza replied as she pulled on her coat. She looked steadily at Jennifer, her mouth compressed into a line of anxiety. And Jennifer, on impulse, stepped forwards and hugged her. Mrs. Cordoza's arms reached round her and held her tightly, as if she was trying to imbue Jennifer with strength, and had understood how much she had needed to feel that from someone. They stood like that in the middle of the room for several moments. Then, perhaps a little embarrassed, the housekeeper disengaged herself. Her nose was pink. "I'm not going back," Jennifer said, hearing her words hit the still air with unexpected force. "I'll find somewhere for us to live, but I'm not going back." The elder woman nodded. "I'll ring you tomorrow." She scribbled a note on a piece of hotel writing paper. "You can tell him where we are. It's probably best that he knows." That night, after she had put Esme to bed, she rang all the newspapers in Fleet Street to ask if she could send messages to their correspondents on the off chance that they might run into Anthony in Central Africa. She telephoned an uncle who, she remembered, had once worked out there, and asked if he could recall the names of any hotels. She placed calls with the international operator to 2 hotels, one in Brazzaville, the other in Stanleyville, and left messages with receptionists, one of whom told her mournfully, "Madam, we have no white people here. There is trouble in our city." "Please," she said, "just remember his name, Anthony O'Hare. Tell him Boot. He'll know what it means." She had sent another letter to the newspaper to be forwarded to him. I'm sorry. Please come back to me. I'm free. And I'm waiting for you. She had handed it over at reception, telling herself as she did so that once it was gone, it was gone. She mustn't think about its progress, mustn't imagine over the next days or weeks where it lay. She had done what she could, and now it was time to focus on building a new life, ready for when one of the many messages reached him. Mr. Grosvenor was grinning again. It seemed a reflexive rictus thing, and she tried to ignore it. It was the 11th day.
If you could just put your signature there.
He pointed with a beautifully manicured finger.
And there. Then, of course, we'll need your husband's signature. Here.
He smiled again, his lips wavering a little. Oh, you'll need to send them to him directly, she said. Around them, the tea room of the Regent Hotel was filled with women, retired gentlemen, anyone diverted from shopping by a wet Wednesday afternoon.
I beg your pardon.
I no longer live with my husband. We communicate by letter. That floored him. The grin disappeared, and he snatched at the papers on his lap as if he was trying to regroup his thoughts. I believe I've already given you his home address. There. She pointed to one of the letters in the folder. And we'll be able to move in next Monday, will we? My daughter and I are wearying of hotel living. Outside somewhere, Mrs. Cordoza was taking Esme to the swings. She came daily now, during the hours that Lawrence was at his office. There's so little to do in that house without you, she had said. Jennifer had seen the older woman's face light up when she held Esme, and sensed that she far preferred being with them in the hotel than in the empty house on the square. Mr. Grosvenor's brow knitted.
Ah, Mrs. Sterling, may I just establish, are you saying you will not be living in the property with Mr. Sterling? It's just that the landlord is a respectable gentleman. He was under the impression that he would be let into a family.
He is let into a family.
But you just said,
Mr. Grosvenor, we will be paying £24 a week for this short let. I am a married woman. I'm sure a man like you would agree that how often, and indeed whether, my husband resides there with me is nobody's business but our own. His raised palm was conciliatory, a flush staining the skin around his collar. He began to stutter an apology. It's just... He was interrupted by a woman calling her name urgently. Jennifer shifted in her chair to see Yvonne Moncrief stalking across the crowded tea room, her wet umbrella already thrust at an unsuspecting waiter.
So, you're here.
Yvonne,
where have you been? I've had absolutely no idea what was going on. I got out of hospital last week and your ruddy housekeeper wouldn't tell me a damn thing. And then Francis says...
She stopped, having realised how far her voice had carried. The tea room had hushed, and the faces around them were agog. Will you excuse us, Mr. Grosvenor? I do believe we've finished, Jennifer said. He was already standing, had gathered his briefcase, and now snapped it shut emphatically.
I'll get those papers to Mr. Sterling this afternoon, and I'll be in touch.
He made his way towards the lobby. When he had gone, Jennifer put a hand on her friend's arm. I'm sorry, she said. There's an awful lot to explain. Have you got time to come upstairs? Yvonne Moncrief had spent 4 weeks in hospital, 2 weeks before and 2 weeks after the birth of baby Alice. She had been so poleaxed by exhaustion when she'd returned home that it had taken her a further week to work out how long it had been since she had seen Jennifer. She had called twice next door, to be told only that Mrs. Sterling was not there at present. A week later, she had decided to find out what was going on.
Your housekeeper just kept shaking her head at me, telling me I had to speak to Larry.
I suppose he'd have told her not to say anything.
About what?
Yvonne threw her coat onto the bed and sat down on one of the upholstered chairs.
Why on earth are you staying here? Have you and Larry had a row?
There were mauve shadows under Yvonne's eyes, but her hair was immaculate still. She already seemed strangely distant, A relic from another life, Jennifer thought. I've left him, she said. Yvonne's large eyes travelled over her face. Larry got drunk at ours the night before last. Very drunk. I assumed it was business, and went up to bed with the baby, leaving the men to it. When Francis came up, I was half asleep, but I heard him say that Larry had told him you have a lover, and that you'd taken leave of your senses. I thought I must have dreamt it. Well, she said slowly, part of that is true. Yvonne's hand flew to her mouth. Oh, Lord, not Reggie. Jennifer shook her head, raised a smile. No. She sighed. Yvonne, I've missed you awfully. I so wanted to talk to you. She told her friend the story, bypassing some of the details, but allowing most of the truth to come out. It was Yvonne, after all. The simple words, echoing in the still room, seemed to belie the enormity of what she had gone through over the past weeks. Everything had changed. Everything. She finished with a flourish. I'll find him again. I know I will. I just have to explain. Yvonne had been listening intently, and Jennifer was struck by how much she had missed her acerbic, straight-talking presence. Finally, Yvonne smiled tentatively. I'm sure he'd forgive you, she said. What? Larry, I'm sure he'd forgive you. Larry? Jennifer sat back. Yes. But I don't want to be forgiven. You can't do this, Jenny. He has a mistress. Oh, you can get rid of her. She's just a secretary, for goodness sake. Tell him you want to make a fresh start. Tell him that's what he has to do, too. Jennifer almost stumbled over the words. But I don't want him, Yvonne. I don't want to be married to him. You'd rather wait for some penniless playboy reporter who might not even come back. Yes, I would. Yvonne reached into her handbag, lit a cigarette, and blew a long plume of smoke into the centre of the room. What about Esme? What about Esme? How is she going to cope, growing up with no father? She will have a father. She'll see him all the time. In fact, she's going to stay there this weekend. I wrote to him, and he has written back, confirming it. You know, the children of divorced parents get terribly teased at school. The Allsop girl is in an awful state. We're not getting divorced. None of her school friends need to know anything. Yvonne was still pulling determinedly at her cigarette. Jennifer's voice softened. Please try to understand. There's no reason why Lawrence and I shouldn't live apart. Society is changing. We don't have to be trapped in something that... I'm sure Lawrence will be far happier without me. And it doesn't have to affect anything. Not really. You and I can stay the same. In fact, I was thinking perhaps we could get the children together this week. Perhaps take them to Madame Tussaud's. I know Esme is desperate to see Dotty. Madame Tussaud's. Or Kew Gardens. It's just that the weather... Stop. Yvonne raised an elegant hand. Just stop. I can't listen to another word. My goodness, you really are the most extraordinarily selfish woman I've ever met. She stubbed out her cigarette, stood up and reached for her coat. What do you think life is, Jennifer? Some kind of fairy tale? You think we don't all get fed up with our husbands? Why should you behave like that and expect us just to carry on around you while you gad about as if you weren't even married? If you want to live in a state of moral degeneracy, that's fine. But you have a child. A husband and a child. And you can't expect the rest of us to condone your behaviour. Jennifer's mouth opened. Yvonne turned away as if she couldn't even look at her. And I won't be the only one who feels like this. I suggest you think very carefully about what you do next. She tucked her coat over her arm and left. 3 hours later, Jennifer had made her decision. At midday, Embakasi Airport was a melee of activity. Having picked up her suitcase from the stuttering conveyor belt, Jennifer fought her way to the lavatory, splashed cold water over her face, and changed into a clean blouse. She pinned back her hair, the heat already moistening her neck. When she emerged, her blouse was stuck to her back within seconds. The airport was teeming with people who stood in unruly queues or in groups, shouting at each other in place of conversation. She was briefly paralysed, watching brightly clad African women jostle with suitcases and huge laundry bags, bound with rope, balanced on their heads. Nigerian businessmen smoked in the corners, their skin shining, while small children ran in and out of those seated on the floor. A woman with a small barrow pushed her way through, selling drinks. The departure boards revealed that several flights were delayed, and gave no clues to when that might be rectified. In contrast to the noise in the airport building, it was peaceful outside. The last of the bad weather had cleared, the heat burning off any remaining damp, so that Jennifer could see the purple mountains in the distance. The runway was empty, except for the plane she had arrived on. Beneath it, a solitary man was sweeping meditatively. On the other side of the gleaming modernistic building, somebody had built a small rock garden dotted with cacti and succulents. She admired the carefully arranged boulders and wondered that someone should have taken so much trouble in such a chaotic place. The BOAC and East African Airways desks were shut, so she fought her way back through the crowd, ordered a cup of coffee at the bar, grabbed a table and sat down, hemmed in by other people's suitcases, woven baskets, and a baleful cockerel, its wings bound to its body with a school tie. What would she say to him? She pictured him in some foreign correspondence club, perhaps miles from the real action, where journalists gathered to drink and discuss the day's events. Would he be drinking? It was a tight little world, he had told her. Once she got to Stanleyville, someone would know him. Someone would be able to tell her where he was. She pictured herself arriving, exhausted, at the club, a recurring image that had kept her going for the last few days. She could see him so clearly, standing under a whirring fan, perhaps chatting to a colleague, and then his amazement at the sight of her. She understood his expression. For the last 48 hours she had barely been able to recognise herself. Nothing in her life had prepared her for what she had done. Nothing had suggested she might even be capable of it. And yet, from the moment she had climbed aboard the aircraft, for all her fear, she had felt curiously elated, as if this might be it. This might be the business of living. And if only for that moment of intense feeling, she felt a curious kinship with Anthony O'Hare. She would find him. She had taken charge of events rather than allowing herself to be buffeted along by them. She would decide her own future. She banished thoughts of Esme, telling herself that this would have been worthwhile when she was able to introduce Anthony to her. Eventually, a young man in a smart burgundy uniform took a seat at the BOAC counter. She left her coffee where it was and half ran across the concourse to the counter. "I need a ticket to Stanleyville," she said, scrambling in her handbag for money. "The next flight out. Do you need my passport?" The young man stared at her. "No, madam," he said, his head moving briskly from side to side. "No flying to Stanleyville."
"But I was told you ran a direct route."
"I'm very sorry. All flights to Stanleyville are suspended."
She gazed at him in mute frustration until he repeated himself. Then dragged her suitcase across to the EAA desk. The girl there had the same